this is just a rock and roll subject. I love the Enneagram, and it's just such a brilliant part of integral recovery. And you guys have probably, you know something about it, and have probably identified your points. And it's just extraordinary. You know, it's like, who was it that said to me? Anyway, one of my integral friends said, you know, it takes X amount of time to learn the integral map, which means that the more you keep looking at it, the deeper, you know, the more it reveals to you about the nature of the universe. So it's not like, oh, I got aqua. Well, yeah. And it's like, oh, I understand the Enneagram. Well, yeah. It's like, oh, I do an interior practice. Yeah, we just keep deepening and deepening. And so the more that you work with the Enneagram and the more you give yourself to, you know, to the field of study, both experientially and theoretically, the more it will reveal to you. And it is just a, I think it's just a game changer. And it's one of those things that came out of the wisdom teachings of human beings. So it's not, you know, it's not so much a, you know, result of the, or a product of the Enlightenment or modernity and the scientific revolution. Although it can be, obviously, with Aqual, it's blended in with that. It comes from that deep, intuitive, you know, understanding. And people say, well, have you done research on this? You know, like you can, I mean, I guess there's been some, but it's like, that kind of misses the mark. And of course, you can, do tests on phenomenology and do on personality types and stuff like that. But this stuff is really revealed from kind of a deeper source, and not that's putting that down. But the more you work with it, kind of the more, you know, the obviousness of what's going on is just so resonant with understanding yourself and understanding others. And, you know, when this thing has been around for a long time, there's a bit of, you know, I don't know, there's been a lot of effort to find out where the roots of this go to. And our former teacher and current friend, Helen Palmer, who's been one of the real lights on the kind of this period that we're living through, which is really the renaissance of Enneagram. I mean, you know, even though it's really old, I just think in the last 20 years, this thing has just opened up in ways that was never quite done before. But she traces it back to the desert fathers and the desert mothers in 2nd century, 3rd century Egypt, who were devotees or Christians that had, you know, kind of was on the second wave of the Jesus movement, you know, and a lot of them went out to the Egyptian deserts and lived in communities, pretty hermit-like existences. They cooperated, but they lived out in their own little, you know, their own little dwellings, and they just really focused on the interior work. And this is very early in the Christian tradition. It was before kind of the Constantine, the politicization of Christianity as the, you know, the guiding, you know, movement of the Roman empires as it stood then. And I think this interiority, the interior practice really got squashed out and largely survived in some forms always, but largely was done away with the dogmatization of Christianity. In other words, you got to bring the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. You know, Jesus was born and crucified, died, third day, rose. All that early stuff that was to unite all the Christian voices and make it the kind of the super glue of the fracturing Roman Empire. So anyway, this stuff was happening before that. And they said that Helen has found in their writings that they were identifying certain types of individuals that were these mystical monks living out in the desert, and that they had different the nine different points, and they had different challenges and different struggles in their quest to find God in the desert and in the solitude and in themselves. And so she traces it back there, and other authors have traced it back to ancient Babylonia, and of course Gurdjieff, I think was from Georgia. Not U.S. Georgia, but Russian or near Russia, former Soviet Georgia, was one of the people that brought in his school. But from what I've seen looking at his maps, a very kind of simplified version that he learned from adepts in his travels, than what we're doing now. And there's two layers to this thing. There's kind of the pop psychology layer of it, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. When you identify certain points and the way people operate, and you know, you know, just the ego stuff, which is very useful. And when Helen Palmer started teaching this stuff, she was taking it out of the esoteric schools and bringing it into the popular kin, if you will, and which is a word for knowledge. It's not Ken Wilber, but you know, anyway, it's interesting. His name is that. And she got a lot of heat. Jack got sued. And we met her recently at these integral gatherings the last few years. And she said that, you know, that we studied with her in graduate school at JFK, back in the late 80s. And she said that was the first time that she'd ever taught this stuff in public, when she was teaching our classes and we were learning the DSM-3, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. It's version 5 is out now. So we were learning that as kind of the standard typology of all these different pathologies, and kind of, you know, the hoops you had to jump through in order to get insurance money. So they'd keep coming up and working through these pathologies. And if you're a borderline personality disorder, if you meet, you know, criteria, 5 of the 8 criteria, so on and so forth. Same time we were learning, Helen was teaching us the Enneagram, which is really interesting, kind of making those comparisons. And when I look back on it, it was probably the best thing that I learned when I was in graduate school, besides meeting Pam. Very useful stuff. And I began to teach it to teenagers, adolescents in the wilderness, usually when we get stuck in a snowstorm in some old funky tent or a cave or alcove somewhere, and we had a lot of time on. And I'd start teaching the basics of the Enneagram, and the students would just light up, you know, because there's really nothing more interesting to somebody than themselves. And then when you start shining a little light on it, anyway, it was very illuminating. And brilliantly, I think Ken in the Aqual or the integral map included typologies, and the one that has really seemed to really, you know, just really find roots deep into the, you know, the early evolutions of this integral thing has been the Enneagram, because it's such a, you know, it deals both on the ego level and on the transcendent level, which is, you know, one of the things that characterizes integral. We look at the surfaces, but we also look at the depths, and both are necessary. So, Pam, would you like to add anything onto that?
Yeah, sure. First of all, we set up some resources in the resource section of the tab of the IRI website. So if you go there, you'll see links to some images that we'll probably be focusing on, and some of the teachers that we familiar with, work with, that kind of thing. So, and there's one fellow down there. John doesn't know as much about him, and I'm just learning about him. His name is Michael Naylor, and he's in the Rizzo-Hudson tradition. But he's really focused on the Enneagram recovery. And each year, he's sort of slow, but he's slowly developing more and more material. He'll be coming out with a book that's really dedicated to Enneagram and the recovery. So I would check out that link and his resources. He's a good writer, and really gets into the nitty-gritty. I've been impressed with his work.
Hi, Pam. Where is that link that you're referring to?
Go to IRI and then the resources tab.
Okay. Resources. Okay. Yeah.
We put that tab in more recently.
Okay, I see it.
And do you see the features?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
So, our guy, our Bob, have they shown up?
Not yet.
Okay.
Bob can't make it, but Guy was going to listen in.
Good. Okay. So, yeah, anything besides that you'd like to say, Pam? Before I just jump into this with both feet?
Yeah. Well, as John said, you know, we were first introduced to it at JFK. And what I loved about the way that they taught at JFK was that they taught the Enneagram and the DSM, and they taught a body-based method for assessment. So very early on in our training, we kind of learned that these are maps. They're not the thing itself. These are maps. And I appreciated that because you can use them or not use them as they are useful. And the Enneagram for me certainly turned out to be incredibly useful. I use it both for self-knowledge, but also in my work as a therapist, putting teams together of line staff, and also for staff development, and also with clients. It was useful for me both if I would walk out into the group and see a new client that I would have kind of negative reactions to. It would give me clues about myself and also clues about the client. And it also was helpful in working with clients to help them look at the patterns that they were doing that were not furthering what really mattered to them. And I'll get more into that as we get into the points.
Can I interrupt?
So it's a great, pardon me, hold on 1 second.
Pam, you still there? Anybody there?
I'm here.
Is that Hamlet?
Oh, here. Pam has muted herself for some reason for a moment.
Oh. Well, yeah. So does everybody have the picture of the symbols?
Sorry, you guys. I got interrupted.
Okay. So does everybody have a picture of the Enneagram? It's really nice to look at. There's one called the Three Centers of Intelligence, which we'll see how much time we have. There's a lot to talk about, you know, so this might be part A or part B or part one of a series of lectures on this. But yeah, if you have the picture in front of you, you can see.
So you guys, Pam's put the picture up, the Enneagram, the Three Centers of Intelligence, right? That there's a link in the resources.
No, there's not the Three Centers of Intelligence. There's directionality, stereotypes, and a values map. I can get that one too.
Okay, we'll do that. Do people just have a picture of the Enneagram, Pam?
They're going to the page on the web page, and then they can click on three different images. And I sent you those three images.
All right.
I have Three Centers of Intelligence pulled up.
Brilliant. So, I mean, we can look at any of them, but I just want people to have a basic picture of it. So what we're talking about, Enneagram is Greek for a nine-pointed geometrical form or symbol. And so that's what we have. And so there are nine basic personality types. But as you can see, there's arrows going every which way. And there's a lot of complexity here. Like, so for example, the 5, 6, and 7 are considered mental points. So in other words, when something happens out there in the world, the 5, 6, and 7 tend to lead with the mind, you know, thinking about it, trying to figure it out. And the 8, 9, and 1 are referred to as body points, which means they're more sensation based. In other words, they tap into what's going on in their body. When somebody walks in the room and their body starts, you know, the gut starts kind of freaking out, you know, that's what they pay attention to, the kind of intuitive body felt sense. And the 2, 3, and 4 are considered, they're called the heart points, which kind of makes you say, oh, they just open up the heart. No, they don't. It's really kind of a misnomer. They're kind of the fix-it points. In other words, when something is going on out there in the world, they want to fix it to make it right. Okay? Doesn't necessarily mean they've opened their hearts. But, you know, the 2 will be the helper. The 4 will try to, you know, go out and do its thing. And 3, of course, is the achiever. So they'll try to fix things in the outer world. So those are just basic responses. And each of the points goes to one of the other points when they are getting it together, when they are ascending, or when they're under stress. And I read one book by one author says you can go positive or negative both ways. But generally speaking, most authors say you move in one direction to get it together when you're getting it together. One, when you're under stress or, you know, devolving. And for example, I'm a 6, which is, it says here, the loyal skeptic or the trooper. And it's all about fear. And there's the counterphobic and the phobic 6. Counterphobic 6 is always kind of the tough guy that goes against the fear, does all these things to overcome fear. And the phobic 6, of course, is, you know, a very anxious anxiety-ridden, you know, very, you know, the world's dangerous and blah, you know, and down at the lowest levels of it devolving, that can lead to paranoid schizophrenia. Okay, all these points have the basement, you know, the lowest, most dysfunctional, the average, and then the higher levels of development. And so as a 6, I go to 9 when I'm getting together, which is a peacemaker. It's also a body point, and I notice, you know, the more I work on myself, the more I become just dialed into my gut, to my intuitive reactions. And what's coming up is a very useful tool, being a guide or a coach or a therapist, by the way. And under stress, I will move to 3, a performer. And, yeah, like I noticed when I play tennis, my super, you know, competitive jerk self will tend to come out. And it's quite funny to watch, you know, because it's just tennis, you know. It's not life-threatening, but it really gives me a place where I can consciously work with that part of myself. And really, really very interesting. So, and each of the points have their own subtypes. You have the social preservation. You have the, you have the social subtype, you have the preservation subtype, and you have the sexual subtype. So each of those points, each point has various complexities built in. And of course, let's say you're a 6, of course, going next to you on the right side, you have the 5 or you have the 7. So people will tend to have a wing that's are influenced by one of the points that are next to them. So I say I'm a 6 with a 5 wing. So when you're talking in integral circles, often, you know, when we're starting doing business or doing whatever we're doing, connecting, people often say, yeah, I'm a, you know, a 6 with a 5 wing, and I'm a social subtype. Anyway, so that just gives you a lot of information to start off with. You go, okay. So, and that's what's brilliant about the whole integral map, is you can just say, okay, you know, this is what's going on in the 4 quadrants of this person's life. They tend to be really into the upper right, you know. They tend, you know, they're like athletes, they work out all the time, but these other quadrants aren't quite as developed. So there's different lines of development. So there's some real strong development in this line, but some real deficits in these other lines. Anyway, so then you have the Enneagram time. It just gives you a lot of information. So just from the very get-go, you're not just having to reinvent the wheel and think about, now what should I ask? It's all kind of laid out here. And the more you work with this stuff, this, you just begin to work with it intuitively, not in any necessarily, when you're doing therapy or you're working with an individual, let's put it that way. I don't have this, you know, this checklist where I have to go through all this stuff. And this is the first thing we're going to determine. When it seems appropriate, I'll bring it up. And if they're not there yet, I don't bring it up. And of course, if they're not there, probably not a good client for me to be working with. I seem to be, you know, there's certain, and we need to find, as a guide, a coach, a therapist, I think after a while you begin to figure out, you know, what your, you know, population is. In other words, the people that you're the most skillful and you feel called to and do the best with you, because not everybody, you know, has the medicine for everyone. But I think we can have more medicine for more people if we do our own, you know, work on ourselves, do the practices, and learn this model as a therapeutic tool. So, Pam?
Yes?
You want to say something?
I guess the thing that I would add that I find useful in thinking about the Enneagram is that, you know, it's basically a tool to show me how I avoid being present. And obviously each point has its very particular way in which it avoids being kind of present now.
And what do you mean by being present, Pam? Define that.
I mean being, you know, in this moment with whatever is happening. You know, there's different sort of ways we avoid, you know, being present to the pain that we're experiencing. And, you know, for instance, the 9 avoids, or procrastinates or numbs out, you know, the 3 buries itself in doing. And those are just a few examples. And I think we should get into the different points.
Yeah.
And not spend as much time at this stage on the subtypes.
Right.
Which John mentioned a moment ago, the security, the self-pres, the one-on-one, and the group, nor not too much time on the wings. I think it'd be great to just sort of focus on the
That's what I wanted to do, but what I wanted to do is give this, you know, an overview to see the complexity that you can move into. It's not just points. There's a lot more to it.
Yeah, absolutely.
To learn. So, yeah, and, you know, when Pam says present, that also can mean mindful. In other words, you have the observer self on, so you can, even though you may be doing whatever, like studying history. I mean, how do you be present and study history? Well, if the observer self is awake, you can think about the past or the future and be present at the same time. I think one of the errors of green thing is that present means there is no future, there is no past, I'm just here eating cereal, you know. Well, no. You can actually be present doing all these things. It also involves being in these flow states, these really created things where you're just matched up body, mind, intuitive sense, and you're just in the zone. It's wonderful when you do that, whether you're doing therapy as a client or a therapist or playing music or writing a book or, you know, grocery shopping, whatever it is. So those are some of the characteristics of when Pam talks about presence. So let us begin with the points. Now, is there anybody here in this conversation who hasn't self-identified what point they are on the Enneagram?
Hamlet. It's Heidi talking. I know Hamlet.
Speaking for Hamlet?
Well, he was just talking about it.
Come on.
I've taken the test twice, and I'm sort of split between a 3 and a 7, and I was listening to Leslie Hirschberger on the Integral website this morning speak on how 3 and 7s are very similar, which brought me some relief because I'm like, okay, well, at least I'm on the right track. So I don't know. I really I'm looking at the values right now that you have listed on one of the diagrams. The values of 3 and the values of 7. And I think I tend more towards a 3, but I don't know if that's what I want to be or if that's who I really am. You know, it's kind of confusing, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, you're getting some major clues. And, of course, when you're doing your practice, you can kind of hang out with that question, you know, what really, you know, is love. And then there's just levels of values that can be really surfacey stuff and really deep stuff. And it's very interesting you said that, and this is kind of a, you know, a footnote, but often 3s and 7s look very much alike. And so, you know, Pam and I, with the work with iAwake, you know, we deal with a lot of business people, entrepreneurs, marketers, et cetera. And when you get, you know, some people oftentimes, well, it's either 3 or 7, you know. And then we work further, and it finally, you know, oh, no, he's a 7. But, yeah, they can look very similar. So we found that also. And I think it's really clear to learn, I mean, to see that it's not just about learning your point, which I think is a good place to start, you know, because the more, you know, the more knowledge one has of oneself, the more wisdom one can achieve and the more functional. And there's all kinds of benefits that come from knowing this. But as you move out into the world, it's very important to understand the other points, because they may be your clients. They may be your, you know, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, your wife, your partner, whoever, your family. And one of the things that we were doing the residential stuff, we would pipe Leslie Hirschberger in via my big iMac, you know, and the students would be there and she could see them, and she would teach it over the Enneagram, I mean over the internet via Skype. And she said at one point, which I found really useful, you know, it's not just your point, but we're actually kind of filtered through our parents' points. So, oh, yeah, and I saw my parents, and I go, oh, yeah, heck yeah. So one of the things I got in grad school, too, you know, my mom was a 3, the doer, you know, the accomplice, the energizer bunny. My father was a 1, you know, the judge, black and white thinking. And so I kind of had this interjected thing where part of me is like, I could never be good enough because, you know, the 1, the perfectionist from my dad, and I could never do enough, you know, from my mom. And they didn't consciously put this on me. It was just kind of a Pam is reminding me to stay focused on changing the points. But anyway, it became very useful for me to understand my parents' points. Anyway, so you can't just stop with your point and then you got it licked. You have to learn everybody's stuff. So And the book that I just super highly recommend. And what is Leslie and Helen's tradition, Pam? It's where they put the panels up. What's that called?
The narrative tradition.
Yeah, the narrative tradition. So there's, you know, our teachers and our colleague come from the narrative tradition. And the way they do that is they just put a bunch of people who are nines on a panel, and they just let them tell their stories, and they'll ask some probing questions. So the audience can really get a sense of the eightness, of the nineness, of the oneness of the panel. That's very useful. And the tradition that I've been influenced by most is Orisso Hudson that were mentioned earlier, and their book, The Wisdom of the Enneagram, is a classic for the ages. I think it's a recommended reading, and it's just one you should have on your super important bookshelf, you know, where you have, you know, 20 books or so that are just the key ones. So anyway, let's start with the point. So we have number one, the perfectionist. And know that all of these points, and it brings out in the Orisso Hudson book, The Wisdom and Enneagram, have their, I referred to this earlier, they have the really kind of the negative, the unhealthy one, and then you have the average, and then you have the pretty highly evolved. And so the idea is to get to, you know, use the tools to get to the most evolved version of yourself that you can get to, or students for that matter, your clients. So you want to say some stuff about the one, Pam?
Yes. The one, also called the reformer. This is somebody who tends towards black and white in the way that they kind of filter information. And they're also called the judge. And they tend to have a really, I've sometimes said they're like a walking superego, both for themselves and everybody else. So there often can be a lot of internal judgment going on, and there can also be a lot of external judgment going on. So it's said that if you have a one on your team, it's great because they really have a clear sense about what the next thing is to do, but they tend to put what's right above relationship. So they won't know how to work with a team effectively to get the team heading in the right direction.
Yeah, and when Pam says super ego, that's from Freudian psychology, and that's the part of the ego that tells you what's right, the should part of you.
Yeah.
So the you know, you're always getting should upon by the super ego, and if it's not developed enough, you can become, you know, a sociopath. You know, you have no ethics, morals, you do whatever you feel like, and if it's too well developed, it can become a heavy taskmaster and crushing. So you have to get a healthy relationship, but the ones have very, very strongly developed super egos. And my reaction, I mean, in the past, I think I'm getting a little better. When I come across a one, I go, oh, no, because they're the judge, you know, and I'm so imperfect. I've got so many issues. I just know they're going to nail me, but oftentimes they're so busy beating up on themselves, they don't have time for my stuff. And, so, you know, remember Flip Wilson, the guys that are older, Saul Laffin, that's probably just me and Pam in the conversation, but he used to say, get ready, you got to get ready, because here comes the judge, you know, so look out, here comes the perfectionist. And, however, you know, in the really healthy aspect of the one, they're really wise. You know, they really can be the King Solomon type judge, the righteous judge. Yep. And so you really call on them when you find a healthy one to, when it comes to these thorny issues of, you know, what's right and what's wrong and, you know, what is ethical and what's not. And if we do this, it's going to be good for that. But if we do the same thing, it's going to be bad for this. You know, the typical, moral dilemmas that the existential is about. They can really, really be good for that. So that's where they go. And anything you want to say as we keep rolling, Pam? This is very brief introduction stuff, folks.
Take a look at the stereotype graphic that I put up there. I think it actually does a nice job of kind of depicting in a cartoonish way. And if there's new people that have come on, if you go to the Integral Recovery Institute website and you look under resources, you'll see Enneagram resources, and then you'll see kind of different graphics that we'll be referring to.
Yeah, and also know that different authors have different labels for the different points. Like it might be the judge or the perfectionist or this or that, the black and white thinker, whatever. So if we use a bunch of different terms, it's because there's just a bunch of different terms out there, but they're all used to describe the same basic behaviors and basic conditioning and structures. Okay. So number two. Moving on to number two is the helper, the giver, the supporter, it says on the three centers of intelligence diagram I'm looking at. And the two is a person that gets their sense of being an importance in the world by helping. Okay? And it can be on the unhealthy end of the spectrum. It can be very kind of controlling, codependent. You know, Pam, you want to say some more about the unhealthy two?
Just giving themselves away, but doing it with strings attached, so then they feel really slighted if they're not appreciated.
If you don't realize how helpful they are, and tell them about it, they get bummed out.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of controlling through helping. It's kind of an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, and in the feminine sense of it, can be very seductive. You know,
yes.
Like
right.
you see two women, they're usually like, you know, for a masculine man, they're very attractive because they're so femme. And so that can be part of the kind of the controlling thing is the kind of seductive part of it. And there tend to be more women that are twos than men. And there tend to be cultures that are more two. You know, that are more two, or you'll find, you know, more twos as part of just the conditioning. So anyway, that's all neither here nor there, but it's interesting as we continue to look at it. And of course, the two, when they get healthy, you know, they learn that they have to take care of themselves, their own needs first, and that what true service is, what enlightened service is, not as a manipulation, not as a way to get your ego needs met or your deficiency needs met, but it becomes very powerful. And, of course, you see that the two moves to the eight when they're getting together, which is like the PowerPoint. So there's a lot of clarity and strength that the two can bring to their to healthy service. Moving on down the line, we see the three. The three is the performer, the achiever, the doer, the type A American personality. You know, it's like all of these points have in their unhealthy aspects, you know, or have their DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, correlates will, but the three didn't, because, you know, we are very three, you know, achievement oriented countries a lot of the way in the U.S. and you know, achiever, man, that's the goal in the shallow side of the pool. So, and threes, you will see they can be very chameleon-like. In other words, when they go into a new job or new culture, they can immediately pick up on, you know, what the people who matter, the way they dress or the cool people, and they can perform to that, very quickly. The right suit, the power tire, you know, what a cool wilderness guy dresses like, you know, all of that stuff. They're very good at that. The negative side of the three is, of course, they're a human doing and not a human being. So they can be very shallow, very, you know, collecting, you know, the most tinker toys as the person who wins the game. And you go into a three's office and you'll see, you know, all the trophies and the diplomas and the pictures, you know, them shaking the president's hand and all the cool people they know. And so it's just like, hey, look what I've accomplished. And of course, that's why meditation is such a really cool thing for three, because they have to stop doing and just be present with what is, you know, inside of them and everywhere. And that can be very challenging. But if you, you know, if you're teaching a group of people residentially or even as an individual client, you'll find the three men are taking notes. Okay, this is what I have to do to recover. Okay, so I have to work out. I have to do meditation. I have to understand this Ken Wilber freak. Then blah, 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 you know, they'll get it down and they'll just really start doing it because that's how they roll, okay? And, you know, it can be kind of nice when you have just checked out people and you have 1-3 kind of modeling, getting with the program and working hard. Anything else you want to say about that, Pam?
Yeah, I mean, for me, what's always been difficult is that the threes tend to be very inauthentic on the lower, you know, less developed side.
Yeah, if you get a three marketer, it's like, just, you know, who's not healthy, just to look out, because you're going to get so really good.
Yeah, and then, you know, the flip side of that is that when they use that power to influence and that desire to influence for good, they're really remarkable. And, you know, as John said, they can be great clients, fun clients initially, because they really sort of get things done. But you have to be careful, because they want to look good, they want to be the good student, and they really tend to avoid their interiors. Three is one of the biggest ones to avoid any kind of interior. So there's usually some kind of turn that happens for a three when they begin to go, okay, I got to pay attention to my interiors. Usually something external happens that pushes that. Sometimes it's physical. I've seen a lot of threes that actually get some kind of physical injury that slows them down enough that they have to start looking inside.
Yeah, and if you're like doing a startup, like we've done a number of them, man, it's always good to have a couple of threes, or at least one three on your startup team, you know, healthy, hopefully, because they can just kick butt, take names, and get things done, you know, and there's just so much to get done in a startup. And interestingly enough, I'll out you, Pam. Pam is a nine, and the kind of the deficiency of the nine is laziness. You know, they'd rather just, you know, sit there and, you know, watch the clouds and watch TV and read a good novel and stay in bed, right? But when the nine starts getting it together, they move to three in the healthy aspects. And when Pam is like, man, when she's like doing, she's just amazing, the amount of energy and the work ethic that she can handle. It's just, you know, going from, you know, Ferdinand the Bull. I don't know if you guys remember that children's book, but he was the bull that just liked to sit on the sidelines and watch the clouds while all the other bulls ran around and did bull things, you know, to, you know, Super Pam, who can just do so much. It's quite interesting to watch that. So any parting, and we'll give everybody, hopefully we have time for questions, and we're running out of time. This is part A of the Enneagram. I don't even know if we'll get around to points today.
Yeah, let's see. That's great. Part A. Mm-hmm. No,
so
I don't have any more in the three.
Okay, so moving to four, one of my favorites, and that is the romantic, the individualist, often the tragic romantic. And in the unhealthy aspect, I'll call it the cosmic whiner, like, wah. And it's really interesting point. They tend to look like a romantic. And I noticed when I was a wilderness guide, you know, we'd be out in the wilderness for a long time. We didn't have any mirrors, you know. We couldn't even see ourselves. And but my four students would always... they would look heroic, you know. They'd have the scarf, and their hair would blow just right in the wind. It wasn't even conscious; they'd just be that way. And they tend to be very artistic and creative and sensitive. Jimi Hendrix was a four, and anyway, we'll, if you guys have seen Penny Dreadful, which is I think it's on. Anyway, it's one of HBO type things. It's a new series, and it is written by a four, and all the characters are so four-like. And I told a friend of mine who's a four that also the guy that wrote it was gay, so it has this kind of four gay sensibility. And my friend is a gay four, and I said, man, you got to watch this stuff. And he said, God, I loved it. Anyway, and he was actually getting parties together with his friends to watch the show. So I am also an artist and a musician, and so I really dig four people because they can really follow me there in my love for, you know, language and writing and music and songwriting and all this stuff, really good stuff. Now, on the unhealthy side, the four, they get lost in themselves, okay? And it's like you think they're really deep, and it's kind of true, they are deep, but they get lost in themselves. They just get to the emotional depth. And they don't break through to, you know, the essential depth. So if you're, you know, a therapist and you're working with a person who's a four, you know, you have your first 15 minutes, like, oh, my God, we got so deep. And they were able to, you know, access all this stuff and all these feelings. Well, it's not you're such a, you may be a great therapist, but that's, you're dealing with, probably dealing with the four. It makes you feel good because, you know, but actually that's just how they live in that pretty deep side of the pool. And, there's an extreme, you know, fours, if you find yourself really not liking the Enneagram, it's like, you might be a four because they write, I can't be categorized. I can't be put into a box. I'm so individual. I'm not like anybody else who ever lived, except all the fours feel exactly the same way. And, you know, if you're in a group with a four and they're talking about, you know, it's like, oh, the depths of my pain. My pain is greater than anybody's pain since pain was invented. You're sitting there as a six going, man, I suffer a lot too. I just don't whine about it as much. So you can do that. Now when the four gets healthy, oh my God, you know, they're a force to be reckoned with. They have such intelligence, such sensitivity, and just brilliance. It's just so cool. They have so many great gifts to give the world. And also you're four to know this as an individual yourself, if you're a four, or if you have four clients or loved ones, you know, the fours tend to commit suicide more than everybody else. You know, they can be very self-destructive and suicidal, whether it's in the drug use or just going out and killing themselves because of the depth of their suffering they can get stuck in. So know this, that as a, you know, as a therapist, you're going to have to get them, for them to heal, they're going to have to go beyond merely the emotional depth and get truly into the transpersonal depth. And that's where, you know, all of us, but that's where the four starts to reorganize into the healthy a part of themselves. And when the four is getting it together, it goes to one. So they can come from a place of just self-indulgence and self-referential, you know, chaos and suffering to very ethical, very clear what's going on and what they're to be doing. And they help the rest of us see it also. So, Pam, you want to add something to that?
Yeah, fours in my life are always the most challenging. In the context in which I tended to work with most of my clients, it was in the wilderness. So I would walk out into the, what we call it, the field, but kind of the nature environment. And I would get a new client. They would be a four. And as I got closer, I could tell pretty well, oh, my God, here's another four. And, you know, in the beginning, when they would arrive, they tended to be really caught in kind of what I call victim consciousness. Kind of, you know, as John said, the cosmic wham, you know, poor me, a lot of that, really identifying with that, believing that, very self-absorbed. And as a therapist in the early stages working with them, they tend to get deep in these holes and try to pull you down into these holes with them,
mm-hmm.
into their version of reality. It can be incredibly frustrating working with them. Can you kind of, you know, sort that out? And fourth, I think another thing is that they really can get caught between the path of beauty and the path of illusion. Fours are really, you know, drawn to what's beautiful. But in that desire to be moved aesthetically in that direction, they can get caught in, you know, in what's not authentic, what's not real. It's an illusion.
Yeah, Bob Dylan's another famous four. It's nice to mention kind of, you know, famous people or that represent these punch. Maybe we can do that more with the punch we missed. So, cool. Shall we keep rolling? We probably have time for one more point. And that is five. Five is the observer, the thinker. Famous five that comes to mind is Ken Wilber. Okay? They really love to live in the abstract world. And an unhealthy five will seem to be kind of disconnected or dissociated from the neck down. In other words, they live in their heads and they haven't opened up their hearts and their body chakras and all this stuff. And what is the, you know, the deficit that the four brings online is just a sense of insufficiency, that there's not enough. That if they, you know, if they deal with people and they give themselves emotionally whatever, they'll just get drained. And there'll be no resupply or refueling. And so, so the five deals with that. And, they can become, all kinds of dissociative disorders. So, you know, if you're, you know, teaching meditation to a five, you know, they can do what people think is really cool meditation really quickly. The observer self, they can just dissociate you know, immediately, you know, and see all this stuff and go, wow, man, this guy's really advanced. No, he's just dissociated. So one of the nice things about the technology, the iAwake stuff that we use, it really helps to integrate, you know, the body, the mind, the heart, all these things, and really, really useful meditation tools for five, because they can avoid just the, you know, stepping off the wheel and thinking they're all enlightened and they're just, you know, deeply dissociated. They haven't done the work yet. They're just doing what comes natural. And when the healthy five is, they're very wise. They are the observer. You know, they make, you know, brilliant consultants. And we know some fives that have actually become very wise and good leaders. So they have a lot of perspective. They have a lot of knowledge. They can really, you know, lend, you know, the voice of wisdom and knowing to whatever endeavor that you're engaged with a five in, or if you're a five yourself. So, Pam?
Yeah, working with fives, they often do know what they're feeling, contrary to what people think. They often do know what they're feeling, but they don't want to share it. There's something called the stinge, and they're sort of like emotionally stingy. They kind of want to keep it to themselves. And they have a deep fear of being engulfed or overwhelmed. You'll often sort of, as you explore their past, find maybe they had kind of an engulfing sort of mother, smothering kind of mother. So they're always afraid they're going to get absorbed. So they tend to be, you know, kind of really stay back, stay contained.
Yep.
And so it takes time to build trust with them. And you need to be just really gentle and often kind of engage at the head level initially, you know, kind of meet them where they are comfortable and then go from there.
Yeah. And of course they tend to be, I would say in most cases, introverted. In other words, they, you know, they'll be happier spending time with their books and their computers and, you know, and, by themselves. Whereas, you know, not, you know, just wanting to be with people all the time and having a great time as a seven is. So, so I think that's about all we have time for, because I wanted to leave a little bit of time for comments or questions of the material that we've covered thus far.
Hey, John and Pam, it's Julie. I just have kind of a question / comment as you're describing these different Enneagrams. How do we balance the knowledge that we have based on these spectacular descriptions, which help us, but at the same time incorporate compassion, gratitude, and grace, and not be prejudgmental of people?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, just like any tool or any model can be used wisely for good, for healing, for compassion, skillful means, or can be used to type people, to hurt people, to manipulate people. A lot of that will, you know, just depend on your own inner work, you know, and as we work through layers of our own wounding and our own dysfunction, our own conditioning, we just naturally become wiser and more compassionate and loving, because that is one of the qualities that we pick up as we spend time in the essential self or spirit, God, you know, however you want to say that. So, yeah, so it's, in other words, a knowledge of the Enneagram that is just head-based with no accompanying interior work, inner practice, contemplative work, meditation, emotional work can be very sterile and dry and can be hurtful. And Pam, do you want to respond to that?
I thought what you said was exactly right on. It has to do with your intention, your own work, your understanding of your own, what we call counter transference, your own response to others, and knowing, you know, what your triggers are, and, you know, returning to being present and loving.
Yeah, and you know, you work through your issues. Like, man, I used to have problems with eights big time. Pam had problems with fours. Well, I still have problems with fours, but I always liked fours. But eights really, you know, get my goat, you know. And I it took one particular client that I worked with to help me really see into the heart of the eight. And after that, everything shifted for me. So you learn, of course, we learn to accept and understand ourselves. And then we have to learn to accept, you know, the certain points we're really attracted to. Like there's a big 4-7 hookup, you know. We haven't got to the 7 yet, but a bit of the Epicure. It's all about fun, the next groovy thing, ego planning, but we've got to do this, that, and the other. And the 4 is like really interesting and cool and sexy and, you know, romantic and talented. So, you know, they often hook up and become pals and blah, blah. So, Julie, did that answer your, was that helpful as far as your question went?
Yeah, you know, that really is helpful. And one of the things that I love about this program is it always drives the responsibility back to the owner to do their own work. And it's always just a reminder to me, if I get itchy or scratchy, it's about me, not about the other person. And I forget that.
I know. It's so easy to forget. And, you know, and Ken says that, you know, you can do the Darth Vader move with anything, you know. Like something is, you know, sublime and the religion of love, like, you know, the teachings that we know are pretty authentic Jesus stuff, you know, how that can be, you know, twisted into a thing to burn people to stake and, you know, persecute people and do awful things. It's like, huh? Wow, amazing how that can be done. So anything can be taken that way, you know, for ill or good. And it's just, it's up to us as individuals to do our work. And then hopefully we can influence the collective through our own individual work on ourselves. Any other, you know, Julie, if you have another question or anybody else who happens to be here, or if you can intuit what future students will be thinking at this point, go ahead and ask that.
I have a question, John. When you're attempting to identify someone who is sick, let's say they've had this devolutionary regression to lower state development, do you find that maybe they misidentify or they miss, you know, they answer questions from a certain stage of development, and as within a few weeks or within a few months, as they get healthier, you realize, oh, they were not a, let's say, a 2, or, you know, they're actually a 1.
Well, it's a good question. And, you know, what I have found is that the more devolved the point is, the easier it is to know what they are, you know. So when we were, you know, doing our residential portion of the development of integral recovery at our home, people would come in. Of course, these guys, I mean, we're just getting hardcore drunks and addicts, you know, just got off the bus, maybe haven't eaten, even physically detoxed yet. And it was like, you know, and traditionally it's a self-identified thing. You let people listen to it, read the book. I just say, dude, read chapter 4, you know, or read 8, you know, and they'd read it and go, ah, you know, we had, anyway, so it's really easy. Now they say when somebody really gets healthy is that they begin to take on the positive aspects of all the points. So it's really harder to identify somebody's, you know, doing pretty well, and much easier in my experience to identify the unhealthy manifestations point. It's just so in your face.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and you can't be wrong, you know. Some people are really, really difficult to get, you know, and some people are really obvious, and, you know, Leslie Hershberger, who, you know, I think is way ahead of me in the Enneagram game or the field, you know, she says I'm pretty good. My diagnostic intuitive sense is pretty good. But, you know, for example, our dear friend Diane Hamilton, integral teacher, Zen teacher, and we ran around the points with her a long time trying to figure out what she was. And what we, I'm not going to out her here, as you can tell if she wants, but it was actually the original point that I said, you know, and then we struggled with it for years, and finally when she got it, she like texted me or emailed me, I got it, I finally got it. Anyway, so sometimes it takes a while, and sometimes it just feels just so, so natural. And I think the more that we work with the Enneagram, the more that we work on ourselves, the more that intuitive wisdom voice begins to come online, and we can just, you know, it's just like, it's just, there's just a different way of knowing than, you know, the merely intellectual and, you know, linear way of adding things up and, you know, checking off the points. It's just kind of a knowing, and not to put down the intellectual type of intelligence, a magnificent, you know, evolutionary gift of the universe, but to just know that there's a different way of knowing too that, I think really emerges as part of the integral, recovery practice. And when you start learning to stabilize that and understand it, it just shifts the whole game, because you're no longer just living in, you know, existential oblivion and chaos. You're living in a world where wisdom does exist. So you're able to tap into it with work and luck and grace and good tools and good techniques. Any other questions? Or Pam, if you have any kind of summation or last words of wisdom you'd like to share, it'd be a good time.
I was thinking about two things. One, this is a topology, and a lot of times it's useful, but not always. As a therapist, you know, when I'm in that role, sometimes I use it, sometimes I don't.
Right.
And the good news about Integral is that Integral offers us, you know, tons of different tools, and as I said, kind of, I think in the beginning, they're just maps or tools. They're not really describing the essence of someone.
Yeah, and of course it's a map. It's a map of the territory. It's not the territory, but you know, the territory without the map can become just unbelievably confusing, and you can just get lost and never get where you're trying to get. So it's you know, it's what it is. Just like the whole aqua map itself, this is a very important part of it. But you know, you have to actually walk the territory using the map to really get the purpose of the map. The map that's not used skillfully as a part of an interior transformative and exterior practice, for that matter, is not fulfilling what it was designed to do. And the very roots of the Enneagram, it was brought into a lot of the Western knowledge by the Jesuits. It was always used as a transformational, esoteric tool to really help people find their path and find their way to God and to wake up, and however, you know, whatever tradition is using it, we'll name that in a different way. But, you know, and that's how, when it became all these popular books about it, you know, just dealing with the ego stuff, really offended the original esoteric schools, who thought this was very holy and very sacred, and not just for everybody when it got out there, but you know, you can't keep something this powerful down for very long. And so there's levels and levels and levels of this whole thing, as just with anything. Well, all right. So I think that's about our time limit. But yeah, so we will, I guess, you know, if everything, you know, the stars line up and we can do this again next week, we will continue this. If not, we'll continue it as soon as we can. But I've enjoyed it, and it's very interesting to me. Hope that's true with the people who are present and the people that are listening to these recordings on down the road. So anyway, God bless you all, and keep working on yourself. And anyway, appreciate your presence and your efforts to learn this stuff and to become the most evolved and best version of yourself you can be, because that's really what we're called to do at this time in our history. So love you guys, and thank you.
Bye-bye, y'all.
Thanks. Bye.